Chapter 24 Purity. Richard Nixon rang up the curtain on the 1970 election on May 28th, 2 days after entertaining the hard hats in the White House, in the stadium where the University of Tennessee's volunteers played football. Billy Graham was holding one of his 10-day crusades and had invited the president to speak on Youth Day. It was all an exceedingly ingenious political contrivance. There was a student uprising, so Nixon would listen to students, on a playing field he controlled, where if they booed him, they'd be booing America's pastor. First, the Nixon people got Graham invited to a campus, one big enough to make an impact, but pacific enough to forestall embarrassment. The University of Tennessee in Knoxville, in the heavily Dixified eastern corner of the state, was perfect, a rah-rah wonderland. Big Orange County, where stores that sold Playboy were raided, and students sat segregated by fraternity at football games. And Billy Graham's crusade, you see, just happened to coincide with the day UT's chancellor had invited President Nixon to speak for the university's 175th anniversary. All concerned had to explain their way past the murmurs of protest that the crusade and the university were being politicized. Dick Gregory and Adam Clayton Powell Jr. had been banned as campus speakers. The administration said they were too political. Back then, students received a court order demanding an open speaker policy. And now the chancellor used the court order as reason why he couldn't exclude Nixon, as Graham assured all and sundry that there will not be anything political, I hope, in his visit. Every Beltway insider knew that Billy Graham was the most politically sophisticated preacher since William Jennings Bryan. Then, there were those who were opposed to a public educational institution and a president facilitating so massive a call to Jesus. The conservative Knoxville Journal dispatched that objection by explaining that Nixon's intention was not religious, but to get closer to today's college students. The university, compounding the bamboozlement, said Graham was merely a customer renting the stadium, though the university president had signed a petition inviting him and led the offertory prayer soliciting funds, and the Knoxville mayor sang in the choir and issued a proclamation to all city employees to renew their commitment to God. For liberals who doted on procedural niceties, the whole thing was an affront. The rape of this university, said one. That was a win-win situation from a political perspective. Let the liberals bicker against patriotism and piety at a moment of moral crisis. That set the table for the rally perfectly. For putting such conflicts on display was more than half the point of this exercise. The day arrived. There were fewer than 100 protesters, which was perfect. The drama wouldn't have worked unless there was some dissidence. They were but a drop in the ocean of the 100,000 silent majority communicants, many in white dress shirts and ties. In the stadium cum Baptist Church, the tatterdemalion outcasts became as the early Christians. A pacifist professor planned a pageant of nonviolent protest. Dissidents would join the march down the field at the invitation to receive Christ, then kneel and hold up the two-fingered peace sign at the altar. They marched to the stadium in a mock funeral procession, carrying biblical injunctions on their signs. These were confiscated at the gate as potential weapons. Police circulated Tennessee Statute TCA 39-1205, prohibiting disruption of a religious service, and photographed the picketers. A student tried to bring in a loudspeaker. Cops ostentatiously escorted him out of the stadium across the length of the football field to roars. "Outside slime," one lady screeched. A congregant wearing a crucifix pin was offered an anti-war pamphlet. He retorted, "Stick it up your ass." A cop rubbed his service revolver. It reminded a liberal Eastern reporter of masturbation. The protesters' resolve for a silent vigil began to break down. Nixon's motorcade arrived. The Fellowship of Christian Athletes guarded the stage at the 20-yard line. Thereupon sat an array of Republican office holders and candidates, including 38-year-old Knoxville Congressman William Brock III, whom Nixon had personally recruited to run against Senator Albert Gore, who had voted against the ABM, for the anti-Vietnam amendments, against Haynesworth and Carswell, and had conspicuously not been invited. His absence softened him up for Brock's general election strategy. To zero in on the votes the devoutly Baptist Gore had dared to tender against the late Senator Dirksen's school prayer constitutional amendment. President and Mrs. Nixon strode down the field with the Reverend and Mrs. Graham. A 2-minute ovation drowned out the protesters' 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want Nixon's fucking war. A black minister offered the opening invocation, a prayer for our beloved president. Graham took the pulpit and could have ignored the barely audible jeers, but that wasn't the point. Instead, he addressed the jeerers. I'm for change, but the Bible teaches us to obey authority. In this day of student unrest on the campus, here on one of the largest universities in America, tens of thousands have been demonstrating their faith in the God of our fathers. The protesters started chanting, politics, 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 politics. Graham continued, all Americans may not agree with the decisions a president makes, but he is our president. A Baptist ministry student leapt up, get out of Vietnam. An usher ran to subdue him, but tripped. A woman whapped the protester with an umbrella. The president began his remarks. As one who warmed the bench for 4 years, it's finally good to get out on the football field here at Neyland Stadium. And even if we're on the 20-yard line, we're going over that goal line before we're through. The demonstrators responded with the old football cheer, push him back, way back. Massed together, they were easy to spot. They were the ones not wearing white dress shirts and ties. Nixon made the interruption the text for his sermon. Billy Graham, when he invited me to come here, said this was to be youth night. He told me that there would be youth from the university, from other parts of the state, representing different points of view. I am just glad that there seems to be a rather solid majority on one side rather than the other side tonight. The congregants roared their delight. The president talked about all the young people who worked for him. The largest proportion of staff members in responsible positions below the age of 30 of any White House staff in history. Because young people have something to say, and I want them in the high councils of the government of this country. He said he was for all those noble reforms young people were for. But I can tell you, my friends, that while government can bring peace, that while government can clean up the air, that while government can clean up the streets, and while government can clean up the water and bring better education and better health, there is one thing that the government cannot do. America would not be what it is today, the greatest nation in the world, if this were not a nation which had made progress under God. He drew out his words like a preacher. If we are going to bring people together as we must bring them together, if we are going to have peace in this world, if our young people are going to have a fulfillment beyond simply those material things, they must turn to those great spiritual sources that have made America the great country that it is. Bullshit, 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 cried the heretics, once more drowned out by the pious. Billy Graham took the pulpit and introduced the Negro singer Ethel Waters. She called Nixon my blessed child. She, too, chose to address the protesters. Now, you children over there, listen to me. If I was over there close enough, I would smack you, but I love you, and I'd give you a big hug and kiss. A piano tinkling behind her, she referred to the president as if he were Christ. He belongs to everyone who wants to receive and accept him. The Reverend Billy Graham began his altar call with a warning. If you come for any other reason, you are in danger of blasphemy, and that's one sin that cannot be pardoned. Some damned themselves to hell nonetheless. They displayed the peace symbol. Many more raised their index finger to the sky. Christ, the one way to peace. The flock streamed for the exits. The cops stood by and arrested 8 of the protesters for disturbing public worship. The local newspaper critiqued the unspeakable nastiness of a handful of undisciplined brats and gave over the letters page to public outrage over them for days. The student newspaper editorialized, there was no need for the demonstrators to try to interfere with the prayers or hymns at the service. Their purpose was to communicate their feelings to Nixon, not to alienate Billy Graham or those who were there to participate in the crusade. That made the student editors either exquisitely naive or gifted Republican publicists. The protesters couldn't make their feelings known to the president without also alienating the participants in the crusade. That was the whole point. And the drama had come off like a charm. Time called it one of the most effective speeches he has yet delivered. Newsweek termed it a suitably evangelistic ending for a presidential week that started out seemingly beyond redemption. By the time the crusade was broadcast nationwide, the political juice from disruption having been squeezed suitably dry, the protests were edited out, leaving just the president looking presidential, addressing his fellow Americans, uniting the youth and silent majority and reconciliation. The Tuesday following, the first day of exams, Knoxville police squads cruised campus armed with photographs and 57 arrest warrants, snatching protesters from street corners. One teaching assistant was contacted by a dean's office to get his address to update department files. The cops arrested him at home. Leonard Garment turned off the bad public relations with a wire, requesting they wait to complete the arrests until the semester was over. Billy Graham released a statement. Certainly, a president of the United States should be allowed to attend a ball game, entertainment, or religious service without it being interpreted as political. And thus, the curtain was raised on the most active White House campaign for an off-year election since 1938. The sharp point of the spear was the vice president. Spiro Agnew began the year with a stature-enhancing state visit to Asia. In Manila, for the second inaugural of President Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines, Agnew experienced a rite of passage. His limousine was attacked by leftist students, just like Nixon's in South America. Then Agnew made a frenetic tour of Lincoln Day dinners, just as Nixon used to do. The liberal media have been calling on me to lower my voice and to seek accord and unity among all Americans, he would say. Nothing would please me more to see all voices lowered, to see an end to the vilification, the obscenities, the vandalism, and the violence that had become the standard tactics of the dissidents who claim to act in the interests of freedom. But I want you to know that I will not make a unilateral withdrawal and thereby abridge the confidence of the silent majority, the everyday law-abiding American who believes his country needs a strong voice to articulate his dissatisfaction with those who seek to destroy our heritage of liberty and our system of justice. To penetrate the cacophony of seditious drivel emanating from the best publicized clowns in our society and their fans in the Fourth Estate, yes, my friends, to penetrate that drivel, we need a cry of alarm, not a whisper. Agnew carried the torch through the South after the scuttling of Haynesworth and Carswell via the most nebulous set of trumped-up charges ever contrived by the labor and civil rights lobbies and their allies in the news profession. In Columbia, Strom Thurmond said of 1966 civil rights candidate for governor of Maryland, South Carolina will favor Spiro Agnew for president in 1976. Listeners especially enjoyed his savage humor. The story of how he had argued with the president when Nixon decided to convert the White House swimming pool into a press room. I resisted his insistence that the water be drained out. His worry that, playing golf with George McGovern and William Fulbright, I just might accidentally tag one of them with a golf ball, and then he might respond the way they usually do to aggressive and brutal treatment. And I hate to be kissed on a public golf course. Bumper stickers reading Spiro of 76 were added to a growing shelf of Spiro kitsch, pro and con. Record albums of Agnew speeches. The Spiro T. Agnew U.S. History Challenge board game. Spiro mouthwash that was actually a bar of soap. His face, so sloping and plainer, was something of a caricaturist's dream. One more similarity to his mentor Nixon. Some people thought he looked like a ferret. Some people thought that he looked like a Roman emperor. In April, he recalled how the New York Times' Tom Wicker made a lugubrious lament that those were our children in the streets of Chicago giving the Bronx cheer to the Conrad Hilton. To a degree, Wicker is right, and the fact that we raised some of the crowd that was out there in Grant Park is one of the valid indictments of my generation. But precisely whose children are they? They are, for the most part, the children of affluent, permissive, upper-middle-class parents who learned their Dr. Spock and threw discipline out the window, when they should have done the opposite. They are the children dropped off by their parents at Sunday school to hear the modern gospel from a progressive preacher more interested in fighting pollution than fighting evil. One of those pleasant clergymen who has cast morality and theology aside as not relevant and set as its goal on earth the recognition of Red China and the preservation of the Florida alligator. He referred to the score of students at Cornell who, wielding pipes and tire chains, beat a dormitory president into unconsciousness. The new president of that beleaguered institution released an angry statement. No such incident even remotely fitting this statement has ever occurred at Cornell University. The vice president's office was pleased to issue a correction. The beating of a dormitory president by students wielding tire irons and chains occurred this month at the University of Connecticut rather than Cornell. It was at Cornell University this month that the African Studies and Research Center was destroyed by fire, probably arson, by SDS and the Black Liberation Front with no action taken against them. And that the next time a mob of students waving their non-negotiable demands start pitching bricks and rocks at the student union, just imagine they are wearing brown shirts or white sheets and act accordingly. 3 days later, Agnew appeared on the cover of Life magazine. Spiro knows best, stern voice of the silent majority. 3 days after that, the Kent State killings happened. Agnew had a speech scheduled for that night to the American Retail Federation. He changed nothing, lustily reading his swipes at liberal elites, all too willing to believe that the criminal who throws a bomb at a bank is a hero, and the policeman who gets killed while trying to stop him is a pig, exactly as written. A week after the Kent State killings, the adjutant general of the Ohio National Guard backed off from any claim that his men had been fired at by a sniper. The FBI said that guardsmen had been in no imminent danger. A new photo surfaced, confirming beyond a shadow of a doubt that the closest students were so far away from the guardsmen that Willie Mays couldn't have thrown rocks at them. The order-loving son of Greek immigrants was earning a reputation as part of the problem. A columnist for the conservative Washington Star wrote, "Vice President Spiro T. Agnew, at his unmuzzled worst, is a danger to the country, not because of his own rhetorical excesses or crudity of thought, but because of the response which his aggressiveness produces." 400 faculty members in Massachusetts voted to invite Agnew to speak at their campuses so that he could be indicted for crossing state lines to incite a riot. And when, by the middle of May, weeks passed without a public appearance, the press reported that the president had applied the muzzle. Then, 6 days before the president's Billy Graham speech, at a 500-a-plater in Houston, Agnew said, "Lately, you have been exposed to a great deal of public comment about vice presidential rhetoric and how I should cool it. Nowhere is the complaint louder than in the columns and editorials of the liberal news media of this country, those really illiberal, self-appointed guardians of our destiny, who would like to run the country without ever submitting to the elective process, as we in public office might do." The venom in the address he went on to deliver so stunned expectations that the New York Times republished it in full. He excoriated the wild, hot rhetoric that pours out of the television set and the radio in a daily torrent from the Washington Post, Life, and the New York Times, working together to tear our country apart. He quoted Jerry Rubin on the Kent State campus 1 month prior to the confrontation that brought the student deaths there. "Until you people are all prepared to kill your parents, you aren't ready for revolution." And even so, he thundered, James Reston in his May 10th column saw fit to equate me with Jerry Rubin as an extremist, and yet they ask us to cool our rhetoric and lower our voices. Houston Republicans screamed their acclaim. His claim about Reston, whose May 10th column mentioned neither the vice president nor Jerry Rubin, was a brazen lie. Reston had focused the piece instead on his delight that more and more students were rejecting protest and working within the political system. The lie made political sense. Reston's column was about the electoral consequences of a surge of students working for Democratic congressional candidates, and Princeton's decision to cancel classes for a few weeks in the fall so students could work on campaigns. Agnew's job, on behalf of his president, was to shove such developments onto the anarchy side of the polarization ledger. Hubert Humphrey said of his successor as vice president, "I personally doubt that our country has seen in 20 years, i.e. since Joseph McCarthy, such a calculated appeal to our nastier interests." John Ehrlichman responded in textbook tones of wounded innocence, "I don't think it is illegitimate for someone in his situation to help bring a balance into communications. It seems to me a sort of desperation defense to say the vice president is polarizing people when he says the press is unfair." Ehrlichman added that, after all, politics is the art of polarization. And Agnew would keep on practicing the art. There was a lot more polarization to accomplish before November. The Democrats were gaining traction by hammering on the economy. Nixon could make things easier for ordinary Americans, they hectored, with wage and price guideposts, like President Kennedy's. But Nixon had ruled that out in his first presidential press conference. "I do not go along with the suggestion that inflation can be effectively controlled by exhorting labor and management and industry to follow certain guidelines," because, Democrats said, he was a greedy Republican. He was also a wily Republican, with congressional elections to win. And on June 17th, he went on TV and promised that the Council of Economic Advisers would issue inflation alerts, wage and price guideposts by another name. So frustrating for Democrats, running against a party led by a man with principles like that, though many Democrats were convinced this was their ace in the hole. The president's men were the greasiest of the greasy old polls. The way to defeat them was to contrast them with the idealism of the new politics coalition that seemed to be surging all around. Save the party, save the nation, save your soul. It had been the new politics message ever since the 1968 Dump Johnson movement. The ideals were rooted in the founding slogan of Students for a Democratic Society, participatory democracy. New politics theorists saw it as an increasingly post-party age, one in which people made up their minds via media that delivered experience directly into their homes, and that, in a society where the average age was falling every year, and more young people were going to college, conservatism could only but yield diminishing returns. Kent State seemed logically to hasten the tide. The Voting Rights Act reauthorization vote was set for June. In March, Southerners desperate to see Harold Carswell nominated had quietly put aside filibuster plans. Ted Kennedy and Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield spied an opportunity to lower the voting age to 18, an idea floating around in liberal circles since the 1940s. General Eisenhower had come out for it in 1966, reasoning that if you were old enough to die for your country, you were old enough to choose the leaders who sent you to do it. In 1968, Time underwrote a straw primary in which over a million college students voted. Eugene McCarthy got 285,998 votes. HHH, 18,535. That June, LBJ suggested introducing the 18-year-old vote by constitutional amendment. There hadn't been much movement since. Kennedy and Mansfield decided to force the issue by attaching a rider to the Voting Rights Act extension to give 18-year-olds the vote in federal, state, and local elections effective January 1, 1971. Since the Constitution was silent on setting a voting age, critics argued the Tenth Amendment reserved that power for the states, four had already lowered theirs, and that lowering it by statute would be struck down by the courts. Critics preferred the slower, safer course, a constitutional amendment. Mansfield and Kennedy insisted the foul deed in Ohio made the situation too urgent for that. On May 10th, Mansfield warned he'd filibuster voting rights unless the Senate voted in his rider. The full Senate skipped committee hearings to do so. The House Rules Committee reported a similar bill out June 4th. It passed the House with a veto-proof majority on June 17th. When Speaker McCormick announced the vote, the teenagers packing the galleries exploded. The 80-year-old McCormick, so feeble he rarely appeared on the floor, would ordinarily have gaveled down such noise. But the spirit was electric. He let the hubbub stand. And Al Capp tried out a new one-liner. "The opinions of 18-year-olds are valuable on things they know something about, such as puberty and hubcaps, but nothing else." This was new politics nirvana. A tide of 11 million newly eligible 18 to 21-year-olds to ban the smoke-filled rooms forever, end the war, pass every ecology bill, change the world. The story was allegorized in the 1968 youth exploitation picture Wild in the Streets, in which a rock star led a crusade to lower the voting age to 14. "We got more cats than little old Mahatma Gandhi had." Then Max Frost became president after cops shot kids in a riot, and the kids remade America in their own image. You know, if we didn't have a foreign policy, we wouldn't even have small wars. And at home, everybody's rich. And if they're not, they can sleep on the beaches and live like they're rich anyway. In the real world, new politics theorists were hardly less exuberant. Fred Dutton, the LBJ White House aide, Pat Brown gubernatorial campaign manager, and University of California regent, had moved steadily leftward ever since watching Sirhan Sirhan assassinate his hero. He published a book in 1971, Changing Sources of Power, outlining a new politics Democratic presidential strategy. The increased share of the eligible electorate gained by the 18 to 34-year-old group during the 1970s alone will be about as large as the additional slice attained by senior citizens during the last third of the century. He quoted a voice of this group, a young Harvard instructor named Martin Peretz. "These are times of moral enormity, when cool reasonableness is a more pathological and unrealistic state than hysteria." Dutton spun out the political implications. While the prevailing personal goal of Americans in recent decades has been security, the objective may gradually shift not back to the older cry for opportunity, but to fulfillment. While there have been pretensions recently of striving for the law and order society, the growing want among young people is simply a humane society. While there has long been a preoccupation with national purpose, the rising concern is again with individual purpose, and not even purpose so much as being. The balance is unmistakably shifting toward a concern with process, variety, and spontaneity. There will be an increasing insistence on now. Unmistakably, it was already happening. As Max Frost sang in Wild in the Streets, in a song that made it to number 22 on the charts, in the real, not movie world, and right before the 1968 presidential election, "Nothing can change the shape of things to come." The president had a difficult decision to make. He said he favored the 18-year-old vote, but that its unconstitutional implementation would sabotage its arrival. New politics liberals assumed he was bluffing. Surely Nixon knew the youth vote would keep him from ever being reelected. They were wrong. Nixon did favor the measure. It would help him wedge the Democrats. The people most terrified of the 18-year-old vote were old politics Democrats afraid of new politics primary challenges. Passing it would harden the split in time for when the party would have to attempt to unite around a candidate for 1972. Nixon signed the Voting Rights Bill, he was afraid of urban riots if he didn't, and released a signing statement indicating that he worried the 18-year-old vote rider would be ruled unconstitutional, urging the Attorney General to get the inevitable constitutional challenge over and done with, and imploring Congress to get to work on a constitutional amendment. As usual, Nixon saw subterranean fissures rumbling beneath the surface, understood the enemy better than they understood themselves. George McGovern's commission was succeeding beyond its wildest hopes in reforming the Democratic Party's nominating procedures after the disaster of 1968. Nixon recognized the power of this development to slice the Democratic Party clean in half. It is a lesson of the 60s. Liberals get in the biggest political trouble, whether instituting open housing, civilian complaint review boards, or sex education programs, when they presume that a reform is an inevitable concomitant of progress. It is then that they are most likely to establish their reforms by top-down bureaucratic means. A blindsiding backlash often ensues. The effort to reinvent how the Democratic Party nominated presidential candidates was one of these stories. It began at the Connecticut State Democratic Convention in June of 1968. The Nutmeg State Democratic Party was run by a classic old politics machine. Delegates to the National Convention were effectively chosen by party officials. Only 9 of the 44 had been for McCarthy in Chicago, in a state where most rank-and-file Democrats were against the war. It wasn't fair, Connecticut McCarthyites thought. But then, procedures across the country for choosing delegates to the national conventions weren't fair. In Hawaii, proxy votes were cast on behalf of vacant lots. In Missouri, where caucuses took place unannounced in private homes, one official cast 492 proxies on behalf of a municipality with a third that number of Democrats. In Pennsylvania, McCarthy won 78.5% of the votes in the state primary and less than 20% of the state's delegates for his trouble. In New York, state law prohibited delegate candidates from telling voters which presidential candidates they preferred. 11 states had chosen delegates before calendar year 1968, sometimes over a year earlier, before the Newark and Detroit riots, before the Tet Offensive, before President Johnson's withdrawal, before the Kennedy and King assassinations, before the world changed. 10 states had no written rules about delegate selection. 10 had rules that were all but inaccessible. Hubert Humphrey was about to exploit the messiness of the whole unpleasant backroom system to clinch the nomination. The reformers wanted to make their stand at the Rules Committee hearings in Chicago so that by 1972, no old politics hack could do that again. Do you know what it's like to work 16 to 18 hours a day and sleep on couches and win the election and get no delegates? One of them asked. The bosses were subverting everything I was raised to believe. They were corrupting democracy. The reformers recruited Iowa Governor Harold Hughes, a prominent member of their ranks, to chair a commission on the Democratic selection of presidential nominees to study the problem, and placed their 8-page report on the chair of every Rules Committee member in Chicago. It concluded, "State systems for selecting delegates to the National Convention display considerably less fidelity to basic democratic principles than a nation which claims to govern itself can safely tolerate." It argued, "This convention is on trial. Recent developments have put the future of the two-party system itself into serious jeopardy. Racial minorities, the poor, the young, members of the upper middle class, and much of the lower middle and working classes as well, are seriously considering transferring their allegiance away from either of the two major parties." The Humphrey people rushed out a counter-document. An unofficial, largely self-appointed group under the chairmanship of Governor Hughes of Iowa, composed principally of McCarthy supporters, has prepared a lengthy document embodying a long series of quite radical changes in the convention rules that would seem designed expressly to alter the outcome of the convention by disenfranchising large numbers of duly elected delegates. The documents became the basis for the committee's minority and majority reports. The full convention voted on the reports on Tuesday, August 27, 1968. It was late at night in the fetid, brawling Stockyards amphitheater, and word was trickling in about the violence in the streets. Representative Carl Albert had the 1-page minority report read out inaudibly over the din for a vote. It passed by a large margin. Humphrey delegates had voted under instructions to throw the left a bone, though the convention was such chaos by then that many hardly knew what they were voting for. Thus did the 1968 Democratic National Convention call for the formation of a commission to study the delegation selection processes in effect in the various states and recommend to the Democratic National Committee such improvements as can assure even broader citizen participation in the delegate selection process for 1972. The newspapers hardly reported it at all, what with all the heads being cracked on TV. In 1969, the DNC chair, Fred Harris, named the Delegate Selection Reform Commission and chose as its chair a compromise figure, George McGovern, a dove who was friendly with Humphrey. The commission's 28 members, Theodore H. White wrote in The Making of the President, 1972, were spread nicely among regulars, Southerners, and insurgents, with scattered places for such traditional allies as labor and academics, 2 members each. But openness feels like closedness to those previously overrepresented, and that was the beginning of the trouble. Labor's old buffaloes were used to running the Democratic Party. They saw the reformers as wreckers whose only accomplishment was to hand the presidency to the Republicans. Steelworkers President I.W. Abel withdrew from the commission on the instructions of AFL-CIO Chief George Meany. Absent the old politics counterweight, the vague and contradictory convention minority report injunction simultaneously to recommend improvements and mandate all feasible efforts was interpreted in every instance in favor of mandates. At the first meeting in March of 1969, the only person who spoke up for the old ways was a former Texas Democratic chairman, Will Davis. There are plenty of conservative Democrats who are in control of the legislatures in several southern states, for example, and they are not going to line up like sheep to pass reform legislation. Immediately, 2 other commissioners, David Mixner of the Vietnam Moratorium Committee and Fred Dutton, responded that if anything, reform wasn't being pushed aggressively enough. The word for it might have been revenge, But reformers didn't use words like that. They tended to couch things in terms of principle. The McCarthy and Kennedy campaigners of 1968 had placed their faith in the system. They believed they had won in a fair fight, then that the game had been fixed against them. Humphrey hadn't entered, let alone won, a single primary. The bosses, on the other hand, believed that they would never have become bosses unless they had demonstrated a proven sensitivity to the will of the electorate, a will these radicals knew nothing about. The so-called political bosses were smart enough to pick candidates who could win, the AFL-CIO's political director, Al Barkin, thundered. These bosses gave us a Truman, a Stevenson, a Kennedy, a Humphrey. To the reformers, the flaw in that reasoning was obvious. Stevenson was a two-time loser. Humphrey had been nominated and lost. The old politics had failed in what it claimed it was best at, giving the public what it wanted. Surely that was a mandate for change, as was the charnel house in Vietnam. They insisted it was reformers who knew what the public wanted now. The reformers could betray a certain callowness. They suffered a certain sociological narrowness. You might call them the liberal 1960s version of the kind of people Richard Nixon organized his Orthogonians against at Whittier College. Graceful, well-rounded, fluid talkers. The Toryhood of change. They were people like the spokesman of the Harvard Vietnam Moratorium Committee, who said after Richard Nixon's November 3, 1969 Vietnam speech, the one where he scored a 68% overnight approval rating, what Nixon has tried to show is that there is a silent majority behind him. We know better. And now they were in the driver's seat of the Democratic Party, anti-bosses, who sometimes appeared to behave like bosses, who in their self-righteous arrogance had a hard time seeing how anyone could accuse them of making power plays. The McGovern Commission met only four times. This small staff, along with a squad of college interns, did all of the drafting. The research director, Ken Bode, was an assistant professor of political science who had been George McGovern's floor manager at the 68 convention. The chief counsel, Eli Siegel, was a 25-year-old McCarthy organizer. Both shared a semi-conspiratorial view of how the party regulars kept their power. Both burned with an idealistic flame. Bode had considered exiling himself from America after the RFK assassination. Siegel was so distrustful of power, he wanted to ban elected office holders from convention delegations altogether. They based their recommendations on regional hearings stacked with reform constituencies. They couldn't imagine that the old buffaloes in their back rooms might bear any wisdom worth preserving. They never seemed to ponder whether the kind of candidate that could win majorities in open democratic primaries, where activists were overrepresented, would always be the best ones to win over the full electorate, or to arrest the exile of working class and Southern voters to a Nixonian Republican Party. They viewed openness and participation as ends in themselves, and presumed victory would follow. And when the full commission met to sign off on their draft reforms, the staff bore a certain psychological advantage. It was hard to come out openly against openness, especially when the old, unreformed ways had brought the nation to an inferno. Here was the kind of thing Senators Mansfield and Kennedy exploited when they arranged it so you could not vote against the 18-year-old vote without voting against an extension of the Voting Rights Act, telling anyone who would slow the deliberative process down that the crisis was too great to ignore. Kids were burning down buildings. The conclusion of the final McGovern Commission report, Mandate for Change, released in a well-covered press conference at the Capitol 2 days before Nixon's Cambodia speech, was apocalyptic. If we are not an open party, if we do not represent the demands of change, then the danger is not that people will go to the Republican Party, it is that there will no longer be a way for people committed to orderly change to fulfill their needs and desires within our traditional political system. The only alternative to broader citizen participation in politics was the anti-politics of the street. It claimed that the 1968 Minority Report of the Rules Committee, subsequently passed by the delegates assembled in Chicago, carried an unquestionably stern mandate for procedural reform, which wasn't precisely true. In an unguarded moment, Siegel admitted to an interviewer, there were only maybe half a dozen people who knew what they were actually doing, who understood what the votes meant in political terms. I must admit I was amazed at the way they let us run things. With the best of intentions, the reformers conflated what savage cops did in the streets with the backroom deal-making that wired the convention for Hubert Humphrey. Just as Mayor Daley's police tarred peaceful McCarthy campaign bureaucrats with the rampages of the revolutionary left. The reformers were heir, too, to the spirit of Eugene McCarthy's 1960 nominating speech for Adlai Stevenson, which celebrated his pure-hearted nobility. Do not turn away from this man. Do not leave this man a prophet without honor in his own party. They used a curious word in describing their intentions: to purify the power exercised by future Democratic conventions. But some would say that purity and power don't mix. The last full meeting of the McGovern Commission, the week after the new mobilization protest brought 300,000 to Washington in November of 1969, saw the process's only contentious debate. The first section of the guidelines draft, A1, demanded state parties overcome the effects of past discrimination by affirmative steps to encourage minority group participation. It was an attempt to honor the spirit of the Mississippi Freedom Democrats disenfranchised at the 1964 convention, and the fact that in 1968 the number of black delegates, at 5.5%, was a fraction of their representation in the Democratic Party as a whole. Mississippi and Georgia's regular delegations didn't include a single one. The second section, A2, required state parties to extend the same representational consideration to people between the ages of 18 and 30, and women. Austin Ranney, a political science professor at Wisconsin, suggested the guidelines at the very least urge states to choose minority delegates commensurate with their representation in the state population. Chairman McGovern reminded him that at their September meeting, they had unanimously decided that it was not feasible to go on record for a quota system. Senator Bayh suggested adding two or three words to sort of give guidelines, saying that to meet this requirement there should be some reasonable relationship between the representation of delegates and the representation of the minority group in the population of the state in question. The motion was put to a vote. It passed 10-9. Fred Dutton said the same language should apply to women and youth in Section A2. Sam Beer of Harvard objected. It's not for us to say to the voters of a state, you've got to elect 50% women. If the voters want 75% women or 75% men, it's up to them. I think it would be a great mistake and would make us look really ridiculous. Dutton returned with a political argument. I can't think of anything more attractive or a better way to get votes with media politics than to have half of that convention floor in 1972 made up of women. It would be a symbol that would activate young people. Professor Beer complained, our charge is to clean up this process. Our charge is not to decide what the outcome is supposed to be. George Mitchell, the national committeeman from Maine, Edmund Muskie's representative, said it would be interpreted as some sort of quota. Professor Ranney said he feared he'd opened a Pandora's box. Will Davis of Texas said the South would never stand for it. The vote was called. What would later come to be called affirmative action won, 13-7. However, mandate for change included a footnote. It is the understanding of the commission that this is not to be accomplished by the mandatory imposition of quotas. The New York Times gave the release of the McGovern Commission's report on April 28, 1970, a big spread. They led with the commission's apocalyptic claim that the only alternative for broader citizen participation in politics was the anti-politics of the street. Chairman McGovern was quoted acknowledging that certainly party leaders in some states have been critical. But they were a tiny majority. I expect that we will get a broad compliance. The AFL-CIO's Al Barkin swore, on the other hand, we aren't going to let these Harvard-Berkeley Camelots take over our party. Reformers were confident by the time the 1970 election season rolled around about the failure of Nixon's economy, the overwhelming passage of the 18-year-old vote, the nearly 1,000 college campuses that had protested against Cambodia in May. Gary Wills, in his Esquire article on Nixon's Billy Graham appearance, profiled a former fraternity brother who led the protests. Once he had been the rah-rahiest of raw boys. His conversion was a leading indicator, thought Wills, that tips the balance for Nixon to defeat. it heralds the end of the hard hat war on long hair. That summer, the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment to end the war by July of 1971 generated the greatest flood of supportive mail in Senate history. One letter came from a 23-year-old Marine set to go to Southeast Asia. It pointed out that the war hasn't been declared, can't be fought, and can't be won. The Marine was the son of Senator William Saxby of Ohio, a Nixon Republican elected in 1968 on a promise to rein in dissent. The father was especially haunted by his son's paraphrase of General Patton. "Old soldiers don't die. Young ones do." Saxby let his California colleague, Alan Cranston, who was receiving some 8,000 anti-war letters a day, enter it into the congressional record. In July, Life published photographs of the tiger cages in which our Saigon allies confined 9,600 prisoners on the island of Konsan, some for merely advocating peace. 4-by-9-foot concrete pits, each holding 3 to 5 prisoners, chained together. A U.S. spokesman replied that Konsan was like a Boy Scout recreation camp. Illinois Republican Phil Crane said the cages were cleaner than the average Vietnamese home. Later, Time magazine described what prisoners looked like after they were released. Grotesque sculptures of scarred flesh and gnarled limbs, skittering across the floor on buttocks and palms. 4 Heartland senators, Harris of Oklahoma, McGovern of South Dakota, Hughes of Iowa, and Bai of Indiana, were positioning themselves for reform Democratic presidential runs. Possibly Ramsey Clark, too. McGovern sent a young Denver lawyer, Gary Hart, to Washington to open McGovern for President headquarters. But reformers seemed not to notice how poorly anti-war challengers did in June congressional primaries. They seemed not to notice the overwhelming defeat in Oregon of a change in state law to lower the voting age to 19. They seemed not to notice new data out of the University of Michigan Survey Research Center that twice as many voters under 35 had voted for George Wallace in 1968 than had voted for Barry Goldwater in 1964. Youth's vanguard might be left-wing, the professors wrote. At the polls, though, the game shifts to one man, one vote, and this vanguard is unmercifully swamped within its own generation. States got to work dissolving caucus and convention and committee systems falling afoul of mandate for change. Delegates would now have to be selected via procedures open to public participation within the calendar year of the national convention. Open was a magic word for reform Democrats. They were convinced the banning of the back rooms was what it would take to win in 1972. Richard Nixon understood things differently. His political operation was all back rooms. Reformers, such as Fred Dutton, saw the Democrats' moves toward what would later be called affirmative action as an imperative to save the Democratic Party. When Richard Nixon had made his own steps toward affirmative action, he saw it as a tool to destroy the Democrats. Building trades unions controlled apprenticeship opportunities that often passed from father to son, making construction sites among the most segregated workplaces in the nation. Labor Secretary George Shultz, hoping to reform them, came up with the idea of voluntary goals for integrating government building projects. In Philadelphia, the plan's original target, he suggested a goal of increasing black employment from less than 5% to over 25% in the next 4 years. Nixon spied a thrilling political opportunity. "With our constituency, we gained a little on the play," he noted. But it drove a wedge through the Democratic coalition at its most vulnerable joint, between blacks and hard hats. The president told Shultz to go full steam ahead with the Philadelphia plan. Another longtime dream of reformers was to do away with the antiquated and anti-democratic Electoral College. The House had passed a bill for direct popular election of presidents in September of 1969 by a vote of 338-70. But as Senator Strom Thurmond knew better than anyone else, the South's major political trump card was the threat of a renegade third-party presidential candidate using his electoral votes to keep either of the major parties from an Electoral College majority. Thurmond had Senate Judiciary Chair James Eastland of Mississippi bottle the bill up in committee. Birch Bayh threatened to block consideration of Harold Carswell unless the debate came to the floor. When it did, in the summer of 1970, Thurmond, Eastland, and Sam Ervin filibustered. Nixon tried to use the presidential bully pulpit to force a vote. Stirringly, he intoned, "Our ability to change this system in time for the 1972 elections is a touchstone of the impulse to reform in America today. It will be the measure of our ability to avert calamity by anticipating it." Like the Philadelphia plan, it made him look noble. His motives, though, were not noble. Getting rid of the Electoral College would crush George Wallace's power as a presidential candidate. Unfortunately for Nixon, cloture failed, and the Electoral College survived its greatest threat in 200 years. Alabama's once and future governor, who had won the Alabama Democratic gubernatorial primary decisively, was asked if he was going to run for president. "If Nixon don't give us back our schools," he said, and Wallace was back in business. Enemies were everywhere, even in Nixon's own house. U.S. News and World Report noted a confidential survey of political leanings of career government workers in Washington that showed 73% favoring the policies of the Democrats. It quoted a high administration official, "The president is aware that among the people who worked to elect him, there is a rising tide of resentment against any officials who look as if they are out to embarrass Mr. Nixon, or to try to dictate their own pet policies to him." Nixon proposed a comprehensive reorganization of the executive branch, his second in 2 years. That, too, was less noble than it looked. The advisory council worked in secret, incinerating their trash in burn bags every night. Their plan revived the spirit of National Security Decision Memo 2, draining power from independent bureaucracies, concentrating it in the White House. The Interstate Commerce Commission, the Civil Aeronautics Board, the Federal Maritime Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the FCC were slated for merger, fragmentation, reduction, or abolition. Bipartisan governing boards with fixed statutory terms would be replaced by chairmen serving at the pleasure of the president. A new Office of Management and Budget, a domestic policy council, their duties deliberately unspecified, were proposed, to which Nixon planned to appoint his smartest loyalists, seizing power from ornery cabinet departments, forging a weapon to exact political retribution against recalcitrant legislators via the federal power of the purse. Their personnel would be vetted not by senatorial advice and consent, but by his favorite internal security bulldog, the right-wing exuberant Tom Charles Houston. Nixon quietly submitted the plan to Congress, obscuring its implications. Congress took no action within 60 days, which the president then announced allowed it to take effect unilaterally. Then, by executive order, he created a new Environmental Protection Agency. More nobility, the less noble, the closer you looked. Its 5,650 employees all came from existing agencies. Its $1.4 billion budget taken from existing programs. The only difference being that these previously scattered centers of authority were now directly controlled from the White House. The sales job was successful. In a boon for governmental transparency, the New York Times editorialized approvingly, Nixon was placing the making of policy in highly visible executives. The reviews would not have been so kind had the press had access to the arm of the reorganization presided over by Tom Charles Houston. The FBI and the CIA and the NSA and Defense Intelligence Agency had been carrying on uninterrupted the business of spying on and harassing anti-war activists. Teams of FBI informants, for instance, combed Jane Fonda's speeches for violations of the 1917 Espionage Act, which criminalized incitement to insubordination, disloyalty, mutiny, or refusal of duty in the military, and disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States. Fonda proved a disappointment. She never incited, and abusive language wasn't her style. The president, however, was obsessed with her case. What Brezhnev and Jane Fonda said got about the same treatment, one aide later recalled. And in fall, the powers that be arranged for her to be stopped at customs at the Cleveland airport. When she pushed aside agents who refused her access to the bathroom, she was having her period, she was arrested for assaulting an officer. In her possession were pills marked, mysteriously, B, L, and D. For possessing vitamins to be taken with breakfast, lunch, and dinner, she was also charged with narcotic smuggling. Her daughter was followed to kindergarten. America needed to know, FBI files later revealed. Did her school teach an anti-law enforcement attitude? Her bank accounts were investigated. A friendly FBI asset, Jesse Helms, the editorialist at WRAL-TV in Raleigh, North Carolina, invented a line he attributed to her, praising communism during a speech at Duke. A death threat was sent to her father with a demand for $50,000. The sender, attentive to presidential rhetoric, signed it, "The Silent Ones." The FBI special agent in charge in Detroit prepared a 107-page report on the White Panthers, potentially the largest and most dangerous of revolutionary organizations in the United States. John Mitchell installed wiretaps at their Ann Arbor commune without a judge's say-so. 2 years later, the Supreme Court reviewed the case and ruled such domestic wiretaps were foreign to the American Constitution. Tom Charles Houston wasn't satisfied that any of this went far enough. He prepared talking points for the president's meeting with the heads of the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, arguing, "We are now confronted with a new and grave crisis in our country, one which we know too little about. Certainly hundreds, perhaps thousands of Americans, mostly under 30, are determined to destroy our society." The president told the intelligence chiefs to prepare a more aggressive plan to contain them, and to report to 29-year-old Tom Charles Houston. Houston prepared a 43-page outline of what the plan should include: opening mail, tapping phones without warrants, infiltrating student movements, purging those not loyal to the White House from the IRS. "We won't be in control of the government and in a position of effective leverage until such a time as we have complete and total control of the top three slots," he wrote. He also proposed black bag jobs, breaking into homes and offices. Clearly illegal, he allowed, and could result in great embarrassment if exposed. But these were desperate times. "If we reach the point where we really want to start playing the game tough, you might wish to consider my suggestion of some months ago that we consider going into Brookings after classified material they have stashed over there. There are a number of ways we could handle this. There are risks in all of them, of course, but there are also risks in allowing a government in exile to grow increasingly arrogant and powerful as each day goes by." Brookings meant the Brookings Institution, the capital's most distinguished think tank, professional home to many former Kennedy administration figures. The president found the document splendid. Haldeman directed Houston to prepare a formal decision memo outlining it as a mandate to the heads of the intelligence agencies, though President Nixon did want one revision: skip the carefully delineated procedures for getting the agency's approval. He would prefer that the thing simply be put into motion on the basis of this approval, Haldeman said. Another unusual function had already been placed directly under Oval Office supervision: congressional campaign fundraising, to keep turncoats such as Saxby and Charles Goodell from getting their hands on Republican money. Nixon's lawyer, Herb Kalmbach, forwarded to him a list in June 1970 of 64 angels that might be willing to contribute to slush funds, no questions asked. Old standbys such as Elmer Bobst and Clement Stone. Newer names such as Richard Mellon Scaife and William J. Casey. Thomas J. Pappas, a Greek-American businessman who in 1968 conveyed a $549,000 donation to Nixon from the Greek military dictator's intelligence service. A political fundraiser, Jack Gleason, was attached to Secretary of Commerce Maurice Stans's staff to establish a secret office in a Georgetown townhouse basement. Republican candidates were instructed to appoint a figurehead finance chair and invent names for up to a dozen committees. Rich men started getting calls. "The president is very interested in such and such campaign, and they need such and such amount of money right away." They were told to sign over a check to one of the committees, sent care of Jack Gleason at the D.C. townhouse. It was, the White House thought, practically legal, since campaign fundraising disclosure requirements apparently didn't apply to donations in the district. A team was formed to carry out sensitive political tasks. It included Colson, Jeb Stuart Magruder, Murray Choetner, Lynn Nofziger, and the new hire John Dean, who was surprised, in his first meeting with the president, that he had a rather weak handshake, fidgeted constantly, and was utterly awkward in conversation. The pace grew hectic toward the end of July. On the 23rd, Nixon met with John Swearingen of the American Enterprise Institute about the Kennedys' government in exile at Brookings, then assigned Chuck Colson to work funneling donations for a countervailing conservative ammunition factory, either to the pre-existing AEI, or perhaps a new Silent Majority Institute, or Institute for an Informed America. The Scaife Mellon Foundation and Pew Family Trust each kicked in $1 million. The next day, Nixon raged to Haldeman about protesters. "We have to find out who controls them. Get our guys to rough them up at demonstrations. Get a goon squad to start roughing up demos," Haldeman added to his to-do list. The next day, Nixon savaged Chet Huntley's almost totally negative approach to everything the administration does. "It was," he said to his chief of staff, "important to destroy him for the effect on all other commentators." Nixon acted not despite the silent majority he described as so pure and decent, but in a sense on their behalf, and even at their request. His paranoia and dread were their own. Across the state of mind known as Middle America, a subterranean viciousness was bubbling ever closer to the surface. Jane Fonda saw it in a jailhouse in Cleveland. "What are you in for?" she was asked. She replied, "You might call me a political prisoner." "Well, they ought to throw you in jail. We don't want no commies running around loose." She asked what he was in for. "Murder," he replied. It reminded one of a new movie. In Joe, Peter Boyle played a tool and die maker from Queens, what the New York Times described as an ape-like D's, Dem, and Doe's type, who strikes up a conversation with a businessman in an East Village bar. 42% of liberals are queer, and that's a fact, Joe says. The George Wallace people took a poll. He said he'd like to kill just one, just like, in real life, the Chicago ad salesman quoted in the May 18, 1970 Time. "I'm getting to feel like I'd actually enjoy going out and shooting some of these people. I'm just so goddamn mad. They're trying to destroy everything I've worked for myself, my wife, and my children." In Joe, the businessman, played by Dennis Patrick, murmurs, "I just did. Murder his missing teenage daughter's hippie boyfriend," he said. Joe likes this man very much. Together, they search his daughter out. When they happen upon a hippie commune, their anger turns to lust, and they enjoy the favors of two of the gamines. Thus sated, they go on their shooting spree. But one of the people they shoot, in the back, is the businessman's own daughter. The filmmaker's thesis resembled a book by the radical sociologist Philip Slater, The Pursuit of Loneliness, American Culture at the Breaking Point, which came out around the same time. It argued that people loathed and feared the hippies because deep down they knew the hippies, whose freedom they envied, were right. We fear having our secret doubts about the viability of our social system voiced aloud. Joe made Slater's argument celluloid, an attempt to shock viewers into the recognition that the terminal point of all this hating what you desire was death. The movie's fans did not receive that message. In real life, Peter Boyle, a Life reporter in tow, visited a butcher shop in his Manhattan neighborhood. An excited little old lady approached and said, "I agree with everything you said, young man. Someone should have said it a long time ago." Kids didn't take its message as peaceful either. They yelled at the screen, "I'm going to shoot back, Joe." On the street, Boyle was afraid they would shoot him. New rages dissolved old rules of decorum. The rioting hardhat who threatened the New York City Hall secretary, "Let go of my jacket, bitch. If you want to be treated like an equal, we'll treat you like one," evinced one of the changes. The spring and summer of 1970 were the months when women's liberation erupted beyond mimeographed newsletters and beauty pageant guerrilla theater to the nation's kitchen table debates. Congresswoman Patsy Mink called Harold Carswell's nomination an affront to the women of America for his role in upholding the legality of firing women for having preschool-aged children. 5,000 demonstrated in New York for a liberal abortion law. It passed July 1st, in spite of stacked hearings that called 14 male witnesses and one female, a nun. 200 feminists took over the offices of Ladies' Home Journal until the editors, good liberals all, agreed to let them produce an 8-page insert for the August issue. Joan Kennedy Today, The Midi and How to Wear It, Women's Liberation in You, special feminist section everyone's been talking about. It included a housewives' bill of rights, unionization, 6-day work week, paid maternity leave, health insurance, better working conditions, free 24-hour child care centers. Time put leader Kate Millett on its cover, in honor of Women's Strike Day for the Equal Rights Amendment, August 31st, a feature that introduced many Americans to the epithet male chauvinist. To some, it seemed natural, inevitable. "I became a feminist as an alternative to becoming a masochist," writer Sally Kempton wrote in the July Esquire. The Equal Rights Amendment, buried in House Judiciary Committee limbo since 1947, was a staple of both parties' presidential platforms. And yet, for many middle Americans, it was the most horrifying development imaginable. The one thread that once pulled might unweave the fabric of civilization itself. The lead letter in response to the Kate Millett cover in Time read, "Sir, Women's Lib, August 26th, Fooey. They are only leading us to Orwell's 1984, where men and women are such equals that life is sterile and children are reared by the state in nurseries away from their parents. Brr." Another. "Who is supposed to run these round-the-clock child care centers? Robots? Men?" The Women's Board of the West Virginia GOP was outraged that the National Federation of Republican Women was calling for a discharge petition for the ERA. Equal rights for women were part of the communist conspiracy. Jane Fonda arrived at the set one day for her new movie, Clute, and found a huge American flag draped above the door of her character's room. The hostile act from the working-class crew was intended not merely for her anti-war stand, but for her defiance of feminine convention. She had stopped wearing makeup. Wrote William F. Buckley, "She must never even look into the mirror anymore." Each new outrage interlaced the others. Also in August, black radicals, the Soledad brothers, raided the courthouse where Black Panther George Jackson was on trial for allegedly throwing a Soledad prison guard over a third-tier railing. His comrades stormed the courtroom, tied up the judge and three other hostages with piano wire, murdered three of them, then died themselves in a blaze of gunfire. Angela Davis, the UCLA philosophy professor recently fired by Ronald Reagan, was named an accomplice, disappeared, and made the cover of Newsweek and the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. Actually, at Nixon's instigation, now a 16 Most Wanted list, 9 of the slots occupied by radicals. Philadelphia police raided Black Panther headquarters and strip-searched those detained in the street. Chief Frank Rizzo, mulling a 1971 run for mayor, said they should be strung up. He added, "I mean, within the law." Rizzo was Nixon's sort of Democrat. Chatting with the press in Denver during a meeting of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration in August, the president reflected, "I don't see too many movies, but I try to see them on weekends when I am at the Western White House or in Florida." He lied. He saw about 10 movies a month in screening rooms at the White House and at Camp David, and had caught the new Western, Chisholm. The commander-in-chief reflected upon why John Wayne kept attracting audiences. The good guys come out ahead in the Westerns. The bad guys lose. He dilated on the attitudes that are created among our younger people, which tend to glorify and to make heroes out of those who engage in criminal activities. For example, the coverage of the Charles Manson case when I was in Los Angeles, front page every day in the papers. It usually got a couple of minutes in the evening news. Here is a man who was guilty, directly or indirectly, of 8 murders without reason. The liberal editorialists pointed out that the President of the United States had just prejudged the guilt of a criminal defendant. Let the fastidious quibble. The voters weren't about to take Nixon to the woodshed for beating up on Charles Manson. School was in session. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine hijacked 4 planes simultaneously, culminating in a standoff that almost ended with the empty jets blown up in the middle of the Jordanian desert. Time reported that the Berkeley Tribe editorialized, "Maybe soon, Planes carrying very prominent international pigs will be hijacked from the U.S. to parts unknown by, say, freaks. In Madison, radicals bombed a building in the middle of campus, destroying the entire physics department. They had mimicked the weatherman's standard procedure of bombing after hours and with a warning. That hadn't kept an after-hours researcher, Robert Fasnacht, from being blown to bits. In November, on the other side of the ideological ledger, Rabbi Meir Kahane's Jewish Defense League, a vigilante group modeled on the Black Panthers, firebombed the New York offices of the Soviet airline Aeroflot. Harris reported that 76% of college students favored basic changes in the system, and that half of high school students were disaffected. The New York Times revealed between 500 and 1,000 underground newspapers were published in the nation's high schools. The University of Tennessee's new president promised a reporter there would be no interruptions in the coming school year. "When the faculty comes to me with complaints, I threaten them. Well, I don't openly threaten them. I kind of subtly threaten them by mentioning all the letters I got from the community during our 3-day strike this year. And I can tell you this. We have an academic calendar announced for next year, and we will stick to it." On September 1st, Senator McGovern gave the concluding speech in the debate over his amendment to end the Vietnam War. Opposing senators had spoken of the necessity of resolve in the face of adversity, of national honor, of staying the course, of glory, of courage. McGovern responded, "Every senator in this chamber is partly responsible for sending 50,000 young Americans to an early grave. This chamber reeks of blood." Senators averted their eyes, or stared at their desks, or drew their faces taut with fury. This was not senatorial decorum. "Every senator here is partly responsible for that human wreckage at Walter Reed and Bethesda Naval and all across our land, young men without legs, or arms, or genitals, or faces, or hopes. Do not talk about bugging out, or national honor, or courage. It does not take any courage at all for a congressman, or senator, or a president to wrap himself in the flag and say we are staying in Vietnam, because it is not our blood that is being shed. But we are responsible for those young men and their lives and hopes." The presiding officer rapped down the gavel. "The senator's time has expired." From the Republican side, men rose from their seats. "Regular order, regular order." The former history professor kept pushing on over the din. "So before we vote, let us ponder the admonition of Edmund Burke, the great parliamentarian of an earlier day. A conscientious man would be cautious how he dealt in blood." Richard Nixon was not without resources in the fight. In private meetings with senators, he warned that if Congress voted against Vietnam appropriations, it must assume responsibility for all the subsequent deaths of American troops and would be held accountable for an ignominious American defeat if it succeeds in tying the president's hands. The president won. McGovern Hatfield went down 55-39. Shortly afterward, the Presidential Commission studying Kent State, chaired by former Pennsylvania Governor William Warren Scranton, pronounced the killings unnecessary and unwarranted. But the grand jury in Ohio had already handed down 25 indictments, most against students, none against guardsmen. They spoke for the silent majority, which had itself spoken in angry letters to the Scranton Commission. "What these young radicals need is a good beating, and I will be the first to break the back of one of these little bitches or bastards." It was this sentiment to which Nixon made ready to supplicate, now that Election Day, November 3rd, 1970, was fast approaching.